I call Senate Resources to order. Today is Friday, March 16th, 2015. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Stedman, Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Walikowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. Thank you to Ann and Thatcher, who are helping us out here in the meeting room. Thank you especially to my committee aide, Ike. Today we'll take up House Joint Resolution 4. After that, we'll take up the confirmation of the governor's appointee to the attorney generalship. So we'll start out by welcoming Representative Dan Sadler to the table, and your staff, Ms. Kim Skipper, if you would like. It's up to you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. She says I should fly solo today.
Okay.
Right seat here. Oh, goodness. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Senate Resources. I appreciate you hearing HDR 4 for the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 13. Madam Chair, HDR 4 calls on our federal government to enact a fair and sensible system of federal revenue sharing. Oil and gas development in federal areas can be a boon for the country and for the federal government, provides revenue, jobs, and a secure source of domestic energy, we hope, but it also creates costly impacts to nearby states. The federal government shares the proceeds from such development with some states to help those states offset the costs of improvements and services necessary for safe and responsible development. On inshore areas, that is, on land, the federal government shares 50% of the revenue with states where that production occurs. In states within 3 miles of shore, or near shore, it shares 27%. And in the 4 states bordering the Gulf of Mexico, it shares 37.5% from the, GOMESA, the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act of 06. But current federal law, Madam Chairman, says the state of Alaska receives 0% share of the federal revenues from the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea oil or from other OCS areas. Now, the federal areas off the North Slope hold tremendous amounts of oil and gas, and we saw the supplemental EIS for Chukchi Sea for Shell indicated 3 billion plus barrels of oil in that OCS area. But just as onshore development on the North Slope required investments in infrastructure, development of Alaska's offshore oil and gas will also require investments. We will need to make investments in infrastructure like roads, ports, airports, utilities, housing, pipelines, and in services such as oil spill and emergency response, environmental monitoring and mitigation, and public health and safety. For example, the $2.75 billion generated by the sale of federal leases in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas several years ago would have brought the state about $1 billion if the same revenue sharings applied in Alaska that is applied in the Gulf of Mexico states. But since they applied or occurred in Alaska, we didn't get anything, not a cent. Prospectively, we would have 0% and no dollars coming from Chukchi Sea development going forward. It is an important resolution, and it comes at a time when the issue is ripe back in D.C. We currently have our U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski as chair of the U.S. Senate and Natural Resources Committee. Her position makes this our best opportunity of seeing progress on OCS sharing. Senator Murkowski has pushed legislation in the last 2 years to ensure a fair tax in states other than, a fair share in states other than Gulf of Mexico states, and this will give her support as she pushes the issue again. We have seen nationally OCS policies are in flux with the president who has proposed OCS expansion in the Atlantic coast but cut off the possibility of OCS in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea. I think it's critical for the state of Alaska to send a clear message and a strong message to D.C. in support of legislation to enact a fair and sensible system of federal revenue sharing. I appreciate your attention and stand by to answer questions to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Committee members, any questions for Representative Sadler? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Within your resolution, it refers to the 50% revenue shares for these oil leases, whereas under a statehood compact for Alaska, there's a 90% provision which Congress has subsequently overruled. Do you have some discomfort with memorializing this 50% in the form of our resolution, and would you be amenable to looking at changes that recognizes that asserting our sovereignty, which has been trampled on by Congress, and maybe through political expediency and pragmatism, but by putting the 50% in there as if it's and not recognizing the 90% under our statehood compact. Do you share some of my discomfort, Senator Sadler, through the chair?
Thank you, sir. Through the chair, Senator, a lowly representative, but I do share with you the concern that the federal government has not respected the commitments they made to us in the Statehood Act. However, in cooperating with Senator Murkowski, it's our desire not to raise the issue of statehood. We want to strengthen her hand as she makes a play to get a 37.5% split. So while I do support the overall goal of trying to get a fair split of onshore revenue, I think the offshore is a more particular element of law, and I'd like to try and limit it to what she's trying to accomplish with the 37.5%.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
Madam Chair, it's just these questions about, I know we engage in pragmatism too often, but all too often sometimes, and perhaps there's another way to put in, interject within this, the recognition, and maybe that, in a way, it strengthens our hand. I don't think it diminishes your hand in saying that you have a legal and moral case for a higher percentage. In many ways, I think it might enhance Alaskans' hands. The best way to get less than you want is to agree to it, ask for it before you start the negotiation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sadler, did you have a comment in response?
No. I think that Senator Coghill in fact have a point that might address this.
All right, Senator Coghill.
I so agree with what Senator Stoll said that I actually started drafting up stuff. But right before you came in, you would have seen me on my knees in front of the sponsor asking him forgiveness because I actually got them hot off the press as I was walking up here. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to put them out for everybody to look at, and I certainly want to get the representative to look at it. But there are some strength statements I think we need to make in here.
Do you want them handed out, Senator?
Yes, I could do that. And once again, it was... I asked them to do it as I was on my way to judiciary. They were drafting it up without any comment from me, so it's all conceptual right now. And it's really to go to the maximum that we could get it would to pass legislation that allows the state to equitably share revenue. That way it would leave the 90% thing as an open discussion for us in another venue. And so, because I agree with you, Senator, that the 90% should not be conceded in any form. But on the OCS, we should go for the maximum amount that's equitable for Alaska. And we have good case to show from the Gulf Coast.
Yes, Representative Sadler.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I often find myself on my knees before a committee meeting just to make sure I'm well prepared. I appreciate that. No dollar even play. And I do respect Senator Stoltz's desire to make sure we assert the strongest possible case, and politics being the art of the possible, to assert what you'd like and to settle for what you can get in the rough and tumble of politics is not inappropriate. I look forward to the committee process coming up with a new Bork product.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're going to wordsmith this. I'd be surprised if there isn't unanimous support for this endeavor because it puts Alaska in an unfortunate situation the way we are today, and it's not fair. But with that being said, the impression I get coming out of the administration back east is they want to zero everybody out. So as we argue to try to, you know, be in parity with the Gulf Coast states, they might have a whole other direction, so we might want to consider that a little bit in our wordsmithing, because they might want to make everybody like Alaska, which is zero.
Senator Coghill?
And I agree with you, and that's why on the bottom the page that I propose that we talk about the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act, their intention at this point is to take from the states and put it into what is in effect banking. It's like our,
the mitigation bank,
I'm sorry. All of a sudden, Quality Bank got stuck in my head, and I couldn't get rid of it. So, but the mitigation bank concept is what they're trying to do to the Gulf of Mexico, and I think we need to stand up for them on that account. So that's why you saw me quickly draft language that addressed that in here.
Thank you. So, Senator Coghill, are you offering this as amendment number one? What would you like to do?
Madam Chair, I think I have at least a little permission from the representative to bring it up, but to be fair, he hasn't had a chance to digest it. And I'd like to leave it on the table, and I don't even know if this totally fits within the page and line numbers on this, because I haven't had a chance to preview it. I just told him, I told my staff, give me some ways to make this higher impact, take the 50% out, and address the mitigation bank issue. So I think that's what we've done here. And rather than offering it as a conceptual amendment, I'd like to delay at least one meeting to let him take a look at this, because in my view, Madam Chair, if we're going to make a statement to the Congress, I want the first statement to be very clear. The first paragraph that they read, I want it to be impact statement, and the resolved, I want it to be an impact statement, and the rest to be good history or good gears, good subject matter. But at this point, I don't know that I'm ready to offer it. I just wanted to put it on the table so that people that know I've been thinking about it. It came to my attention this morning, and I've only had just a short while to work on it. So, but I wanted these three concepts to be brought up. And so with that, Madam Chair, I don't know that I'm ready to offer the amendment just yet.
Senator Wildkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the resolution. I've done this one in the past myself and support it completely. My question, though, is on the 37.5%, and I certainly agree. If we can get 50 or 90, that's all the better. But in the Statehood Act, do you know if it says, if it talks about offshore beyond 6 miles? Because I know it's different the further you get out. Do you know the Statehood Act application to that 50% revenue sharing?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, to my knowledge that there is a distinction between the revenue sharing from federal lands onshore and offshore. So while the Statehood Act may have indeed called for it, and we should expect a 90-10 split onshore, that same provision does not apply offshore, to the best of my knowledge. And if I could make sure and clarify one thing for the record, as Senator Coghill notes, this resolution artfully does not call specifically for a 37.5% share. It calls for consistently and equitably sharing. So I think that gives our senior senator the best maneuvering room to equitably argue for the best possible share we can get. I would certainly be amenable to considering these amendments now and making sure they comport with the line and page numbers, but I appreciate the courtesy of allowing us the chance to review them more thoroughly. But in my brief review, I don't see any problem here.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I see a spirit of cooperation. We all understand that the key prize, Madam Chair, is the OCS and some different vehicle. The only reticence I have is putting in a document something that states other than we have so forcefully communicated in the past, and it's only, and I don't think that language is anywhere near the focus of the resolution, but I really don't want to put out a contradictory message, even if it's a sub-issue, an ancillary issue to this OCS, and the real issue is the OCS revenue sharing, and anything better than zero is going to be. I don't think it does any harm to just accurately reflect what our consistent state position has been, and I think it can be done artfully, and I know this is a real deliberative committee, and often the wordsmithing often works better than an on-fly of the amendment. Certainly the chairman has ably handled a lot of these issues, so I'll just watch and participate.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We got plenty of time in this session. Obviously, this has been through the one body and not very many stops to go before it's on the final leg, so we got time to do a little bit of wordsmithing, but we might want to even think about broadening the concept, because Wyoming, on their federal land for coal, feel they come up short relative to the Gulf. Mm-hmm. In trying to pick up as much support with resource states as possible versus just focusing on, Alaska in and of itself and or just coastal states.
Good.
Every vote counts.
So, Representative Sadler, could I ask you a question about on page 3, line 3, and I realize, that may move around, but the Land and Water Conservation Fund, Can you tell me more about how that works?
Madam Chair, I'm afraid I think a year ago I could have given you a long, learned response to that, but at this point I'm afraid I'd have to rack my brain. It might recollect it inaccurately. So I think it is generally considered to be a mitigation fund.
I couldn't
tell you the exact mechanism and so forth. I can get back to you with that.
All right. Thanks. So, Senator, Representative Sadler, what is your...
I would respect the wishes of the committee. I seem to sense a desire to make sure that the amendment comports properly with it. I have no objection to your considered to take the time to consider the amendment. I'm okay with that.
Madam Chair.
I would caution, though, that because this is designed specifically to bolster our U.S. Senate delegation as they work specifically on offshore issues, I might be a little bit concerned about broadening its impact into other issues of revenue sharing, which might get onshore revenue sharing, which might get into the issues Senator Stoltz raised. I guess I would prefer to keep it clean and keep it offshore. But okay. I'll respect your will.
All right. Senator Coghill.
Madam Chair, I think that's an important point. We are going to have to work with Western states in all kinds of areas, EPA and the royalty issues in all kinds of ways. But this outer continental shelf, especially since we have leases that have both been leased and now being withheld by this president, which we've already spoken to, the revenue sharing issue, we're actually going to be joining all the Gulf Coast states as well as California, which probably we don't get a lot of bang for the buck on that, but at least I think a short, sharp, clean statement on revenue sharing on outer continental shelf issues gives us a better tool. So for those who were looking at this amendment, it would effectively delete the first two whereases so that it would take some of that off and replace it with the whereas that I was stating in here, and that takes that 50% question off and then puts it into that equitable revenue sharing. But the backdrop to that is the final statement has to be that that in support of the Gulf Coast states, the diversion of those revenues is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I think if we lose sight of that message, then we get diverted as well. And so I think that's the hot topic of the day while we're looking for any development on the North Slope, on the North Coastline. So, Madam Chair, I feel reluctant to offer that as amendment at this point only because I have not run it through Ledge Legal. I don't know how it works yet. There are a couple of citations that I probably want to work on. I'd rather have a couple of days to work on it. I'm not trying to delay you, Representative, but I think in consultation, as you have with the congressional delegation, this is something that came to my attention in consulting with them as well. And I think it's a tool that we want to make sure we don't fumble. So I think outer continental shelf issues are a big deal right now. It's a good time for us to speak up. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sadler. on the issue of revenue sharing, I suspect the state of Alaska is not going to be the only Alaskan entity lobbying on this bill. The experience is based. You referenced just your both your sponsor statement and the whereas is, I think, on page 2. It references rural communities. Is there a subtle inference about community revenue sharing, or is that you're quite an elegant wordsmith? Some people would say witty at times, as I've heard. But is that meant to be assertive and oblique at the same time?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, you give me too much credit, sir. I think the fact is that in Alaska, the resources are largely situated in rural areas. There is no frankly, there is the development that has to come on state land to support federal development of federal resources will of necessity be in rural areas. So to the extent that that's focused, yes, it is focused.
Wait a minute, Madam Chair. Some rural entities maybe even have more of an aggressive, outside of our congressional delegation, more of an aggressive lobbying presence than Alaska does at times on some of these revenue sharing and rural issues. Is that a fair observation?
Through the chair, yes, that's a fair observation.
So, Madam Chair, so this may be into play quicker than we think.
All right. Further questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Coghill.
So, the reference to the Land and Water Conservation Act and the Land and Water Conservation Fund and the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act. Have you had any study on those? Do I need to bring that forward?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, no, certainly I will review the functioning of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, how much money it's getting, what the balance is. I do, in time for the next meeting, when we consider the amendment. I do know that that's an important factor for for passage of federal legislation, because I think they might tend to pick up more support if they can show that development of oil and gas resources was going to what some perceive as the greater good of environmental conservation or remediation. So I think it's important to make sure that the possibility of some share of federal revenue going to that Land and Water Conservation Fund is important for its ultimate successful passage in the U.S. Senate.
And I noted in here, Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
We would be asking the President to direct the funds to the states instead of to the Dedicated Deficit Reduction Fund. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes to the question of state impacts. And so those two things, the Land and Water Conservation Fund and this Dedicated Deficit Reduction Act, are something that those are things I'm still learning. Mm-hmm. But I think what we want to make sure is that certainly our nation's in a deficit. But the impacts of the state are still real. And the whole revenue sharing was to deal with impacts, if I remember correctly. So I'll work with you on that. But those are the two language sets that I came up with. And I think that's probably something we need to push forward on. So I just wanted to bring it to your attention, the committee's attention.
Very good. There are three people online who wish to testify on this resolution. So they've taken the time to call in. I'd like to hear from them, but I'll keep public testimony open because we will have a new rendition. So going to the off-net, Carl Portman from Resource Development Council is online. Mr. Portman, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Welcome. If you would introduce yourself and your affiliation and give us your testimony on House Joint Resolution number 4.
Good afternoon. My name is Carl Portman. I'm Deputy Director of the Resource Development Council. RDC is an Alaskan-based business association comprised of individuals and companies from Alaska's oil and gas mining, forest products, tourism, and fisheries industries. Our membership includes all of the Alaska Native regional corporations, local communities, organized labor, and industry support firms. Our purpose is to expand the state's economic base through the responsible development of our natural resources. Like the Gulf states, Alaska also contributes to national energy security through onshore oil and gas development and has generated billions of dollars to the federal treasury through offshore leasing. These leases could contain tens of billions of barrels of oil, which in turn could generate hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue. RDC has consistently supported federal revenue sharing to benefit the state of Alaska and local communities. We agree that states sustaining offshore energy development and production deserve a share of the revenue generated because they support offshore operations and experience impacts to local services and infrastructure. Federal government grants are inadequate in addressing the need for additional investment in state infrastructure or the increased demands on state and local government resources resulting from offshore development, especially here in Alaska, which has more coastline, more rural communities, and less infrastructure than any other state. RDC fully supports Alaska sharing in the revenues generated from offshore oil and gas leasing, development, and production. We support HJR 4, especially the concept behind it, and we thank you for the opportunity to comment on this important issue.
Thank you, Mr. Portman. Any questions for Mr. Portman? Seeing none, Carol Moriarty is next on the sign-up sheet here. Ms. Moriarty, can you hear us? Secretary, you might be muted.
Is that better?
That's better. Welcome. Kara, I think you went mute again.
Okay, how's that?
She's online?
Yeah.
Okay. We are having difficulty hearing Kara Moriarty, so I'm going to move on to Pete Stokes. He's also online, wishing to testify. Mr. Stokes, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome. If you would introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senate Resource Committee members, and thank you for taking my testimony in support of House Joint Resolution Number 4. My name is Pete Stokes, and I work as a consulting petroleum engineer for Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska, consulting for many oil and gas clients. I am a board member of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, and I also serve on the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board. Alaska became the 49th state only and determined that Alaska could sustain an economy through resource development. It is important for Alaska to share in the OCS royalty revenue, as the state is the one that provides infrastructure and social fabric, that is the schools and other state government spending that support the OCS development. Similar to the OCS in the Gulf of Mexico, the Arctic OCS development is important for our nation's energy security, and the host state should receive benefit in supporting this important national energy effort. This currently is the practice in the Gulf of Mexico, and it should certainly be adopted for the Arctic OCS as the state gives the necessary support for developing oil and gas in the harsh Arctic offshore environment. An additional precedent is the sharing with Alaska of 90% of federal onshore royalties. Additionally, since the federal government has put many onshore areas such as the NPRA off limits to development and continues to prevent exploration and development in ANWR, it is even more important for the state to receive benefit from federal OCS development. The sharing of OCS royalties allows development of infrastructure to continue the development of the OCS and onshore federal development. Again, it's also in line with the sharing of the OCS revenues in the Gulf of Mexico. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Stokes. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on HJR 4? Okay, seeing none. We'll keep public testimony open because we are going to be amending the bill, it looks like. So with that, we'll go ahead and hold this bill, and we'll have you back another time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to it. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. The next item on our agenda is hearing the confirmation for Mr. Craig Richards, appointee for the Attorney General. So welcome, Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So what I'll have you do is just go ahead and give us some introductory statements if you'd like, and then we'll proceed with some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have about a five-minute explanation of my background, if it serves the Chair.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Great. So thank you. My name is Craig Richards, for the record. 1435 N Street is my personal address in Anchorage. I've known some of you for a number of years. A number of you I'm just getting to know. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I grew up in Fairbanks. My family moved there when I was two from Georgia. I'd had a great aunt, a woman by the name of Mary Shakora, who'd moved up in the 1950s and married my great uncle. And over time, a very large percentage of my mother's family did move up to the Fairbanks and the Anchorage areas, sort of following up from Georgia, that side of the family. That included in 1977, my mother and father moving up from Atlanta. My father was a federal probation officer and got an opportunity to transfer, which is what actually resulted in my family showing up about 1977, about the end of the pipeline construction era. He ultimately served as a trooper through the 1980s, went back to federal probation where he retired recently. My mother, until just a few months ago, continued to live in Fairbanks where, among other things, she worked at Consolidated Freightways, was the office manager at Spinard Builder Supply, and ran a bed and breakfast downtown on 7th Avenue called All Seasons Inn until November, and she recently sold it and retired, so we're very excited about that for her. I went to Wood River Elementary School and then ultimately Pearl Creek when that school opened. I graduated from Ryan Middle School and West Valley High School in 1993. After graduating from West Valley, I went to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I studied the subject of finance as an undergraduate student. I knew that I wanted to attend law school because I knew that I wanted to come back to Alaska, and at the time I thought I needed a professional degree, probably correctly, to at least have something to do back in Alaska. So I did attend Washington and Lee University. After that, in about 2000, I clerked for Ralph Beislein, who was on the Superior Court at the time. And it was during my clerkship that he went through the federal confirmation process to ultimately become a federal district court judge. So that was a neat exercise to watch. After clerking for Ralph Beislein, the first job I had with a private law firm was with a firm called Wolforth, Vassar, Johnson & Breck in Anchorage. It was a firm founded by Eric Wolforth. They focused and still focus largely on public finance. I did that job for a couple of years where I, as a junior attorney, represented most of the alphabet soup public agencies that do municipal bonds and where I learned that body of law. In 2003, I received an offer to do financing from Bill Walker, his law firm, Walker & Levesque. I took on a three-month job after leaving Wolforth's firm to work with Bill Walker, and that three-month job ended up being a 12-year job. I eventually ended up ultimately being a named partner in that firm. During the course of my private practice, I had the opportunity to go back and get my MBA at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, where at that time I had pretty much been an oil and gas attorney as a large part of my practice in Alaska for 4 or 5 years. So I focused my MBA studies pretty much on finance in the oil and gas area, and in particular the subject of quantitative modeling of oil and gas issues, something that as an attorney I did quite regularly. My private practice, which of course ended in November before I took office, had four areas of focus: municipal law, public finance, oil and gas taxation, and then gas pipeline and other oil and gas project development on the North Slope. I am married to Allison Richards. She teaches high school at West in Anchorage. She teaches 10th, 11th, and 12th grade typically. And she teaches English. I have one son. He is 2. His name is Cameron. And I thought it would be helpful to this body to end my opening remarks by telling you why I ultimately decided that I would like the opportunity to be Attorney General. I mentioned earlier when I testified that until about a week before the election, I thought my life was on a pretty defined course. I knew if my partner, Governor Walker, won, that I would be taking over the law firm, and that would be my life. And if he lost, I figured he was going to retire, and I'd be taking over the law firm, so that was going to be my life. So things seemed pretty clear. But he did ask me if I would be interested in the Attorney General's position, which, after giving it much thought, I decided that I would. And it changed, certainly, where I was headed in life. And the reason I ultimately decided to do it was just for the opportunity to serve the people of Alaska. You know, it's not without sacrifices to leave your public practice and spend so much time away from your family, but I think, like many of us here, the opportunity to really serve the people is once in a lifetime. So, thank you.
Very good. Thank you. We'll start with some questions in from committee members. Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Richards, for coming by my office. I always find it helpful to have a one-on-one with nominees for especially such an important position as AG of the state of Alaska. And I want to start out just by asking you, it sounds like you didn't plan on being asked to serve in this capacity, but that you said you put a lot of thought into it before responding to the governor with an answer. And what were some of the things that you considered in the category of why you might not want to do this?
Senator Costello, through the chair, well, I mentioned two of them, but there were some others. The first was that it's tough on your family to be gone so much. I have a 2-year-old, so it's obviously a challenge for my wife for me to be here while, you know, she's in Anchorage. Also, for me, financially, it changed where I was headed. You know, I had a pretty established law practice, and I'm young enough to have had an established law practice, but not old enough to have made a bunch of money. So it was a change in that way to go into public service, because, of course, in order to serve in the Attorney General's office as the Attorney General, as an Assistant Attorney General, you, of course, can't maintain any of your prior clients, so you pretty much let that go. So those are two considerations, and I think with the primary ones that weighed on me, but ultimately, as I said, when I really considered the cost versus the benefit and the opportunity to serve, I think the opportunity to serve won.
And when you,
Chair,
when you think of the role of Attorney General, can you describe to the committee what you see that role as? What is your role?
Senator Gosselaar, through the Chair, well, I think the Attorney General's position is multifaceted. On the one hand, you provide legal advice to your governmental clients, and that means in particular as the Attorney General's office, I oversee the Department of Law. So I provide legal advice to the various state agencies that we do that function for. You provide legal advice to the governor. You serve as the people's attorney, which means that ultimately representation just isn't to any government agency or the governor, but ultimately to the people of the state of Alaska. And as part of representation of the people, as being the people's attorney, there are several aspects of that which are incredibly important. On the one hand, you enforce the laws and prosecute the laws of the state of Alaska. Alaska is a fairly unique state in that we have the prosecutorial function embedded within the statewide agency, whereas, of course, in most places, local DAs at the county level are the ones that prosecute most of the laws. You also do such things as the Attorney General is in the role of the people's attorney as filing rate proceedings. You make decisions about whether or not there are antitrust issues with various transactions and other things, and are ultimately responsible for a collection of revenues for restitution in criminal cases and in child support matters as well. So I would say that the duty of the Attorney General is broad-faceted and ultimately comes down to representing the people of the state.
Follow-up, Senator Castall?
Mr. Richards, in some states, and actually in Alaska recently, we've considered having that position, your position that you're serving in right now, as an elected position. And one of the reasons that many states go to that is to avoid any kind of a conflict of interest that the individual might have with the governor. And can you talk about your relationship with the governor and whether or not you see serving in this capacity as a conflict of interest, considering your history with him?
Representative Castello, through the Chair, I can, but maybe before if I do that, I'll just talk about sort of my view on an elected attorney general versus an appointed one. I think that there are only five other states that have attorney generals appointed by the governor. Tennessee has the attorney general appointed by the Supreme Court, and I think Maine has it appointed by the legislature. In all the other states, it is an elected position. And, of course, the advantage of an elected position is that you're independent of the governor, and you don't have the potential conflict of interest that you mentioned, where the governor's office might view decisions you should make differently than what you as the people's attorney think you should make those decisions. The disadvantage of an elected attorney general position is that the office can become very politicized. You know, in some states, attorney general means almost governor because oftentimes it's a stepping stone for a different office. And in that situation, you can have the potential of where the governor and the attorney general don't work together merely for political reasons. So in my mind, there are advantages and there are disadvantages to both systems. And I look forward, after I'm in office, sort of developing an opinion about which I think is better. In terms of my personal relationship with the governor, when I took the office, I had two conditions, actually. The first one was that my wife had to agree to it, and ultimately she did. The other was that I explained to him that it was, not explained, I talked to him about how it was an independent office, and he had to understand that if I was going to accept the position, that I would exercise the independence of the office. And he understood and didn't have any problem with it and said that he wouldn't have it any other way. So I certainly believe I have the capacity and will exercise the independence of the office.
Follow-up, Senator Castell?
I just have one final question at this point. So the legislature, and since I've been here, I've spent, countless hours in hearings over our oil tax regime, and I used my own, faculties to make that decision and voted to make Alaska more competitive. And then there was an initiative recently that kept that system on the books, and we're seeing at low oil prices, actually that was a pretty prudent decision because we're more competitive as the price gets lower. And I know in the past you've made some disparaging remarks about Senate Bill 21 and also the gas line bill that we have that is now law. And my concern as not only a sitting state senator, but as a parent of young children, I see the gas line, the AKLNG line, is pretty much the bright star in our state's future. And I am very committed to making sure that that law that we passed has its ability to see the light of day if, in fact, we're competitive. As Attorney General, do you feel confident in light of your past activity and support and actions that you would be able to support and stand up for these laws that most of us here voted to put on the books in terms of making a gas line a reality?
Senator Costello, through the chair. So I would hope that any comments I make on public policy in the state of Alaska wouldn't be taken as disparaging. I think to the extent I made comments on behalf of climates or my clients or myself personally, they would have been in an attempt to further public dialogue. But as to answer your question directly, the role of my office is to fully and faithfully execute the laws of the state of Alaska. And the laws enacted by this body are enacted by the people directly through direct democracy. Of course, it's my job to enforce those laws, and that's what I'll be doing.
Thank you.
Senator Stoltz, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Costello's line of questioning, I've noticed a very deliberative expression of the people's attorney, and I've advocated for the elected attorney general. I appreciate that dialogue, and maybe we'll talk on that. But can you talk a little bit about the role of the attorney general? It's almost evolved into a special counsel and the governor's attorney, and how you feel as a lawyer in addition, you know, your role is representing state agencies. Some general discussion of the canons of legal ethics that drive you as the governor is talking to you as the legal client, and you're the lawyer, and how those interact with your carrying out of state policy. What if the governor tells you some things that, as the chief law enforcement officer, and this is just totally hypothetical. I know we're dealing with all honorable people, but we're talking about a process, and this is probably the last attorney general I saw that close to the chief executive was Robert Kennedy, appointed in 1960, and I think that you're probably about the closest dynamic I've seen of a close. Many of the governors haven't even known the attorney generals that well often. But the issue back, Madam Chair, and I've distracted myself, but the issue of your role as the governor's attorney and the legal canon of ethics that govern your profession, which have legal enforcement and broad and specific discussion of that concept, is it probably is more relevant than in many other administrations. And not, Madam Chair, not suggesting anything untoward, but we're just talking the hypothetical relationships.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, thank you. I do think it's important when you're an attorney to really understand who your client is. And the unique thing about attorneys general throughout the state and throughout the country, I'm sorry, in this state and throughout the country, almost without exception, is you provide legal support and legal services to the agencies of the state of Alaska, including the governor's office. You provide counsel and you provide representation. And you do it to the best of your ability and the best you can. I think what you're suggesting is what happens if there's a potential conflict of interest between what the governor wants to do and what you feel you should do as the people's attorney. I think, Senator, that's what you're driving at. And the answer is to represent the people. At the end of the day, if there's any conflict between what the governor wants and what's in the people's best interest, it is an independent office, and you do have to make independent decisions. But I will say I've been a practicing attorney my whole life, and I'm generally able to sit down with reasonable people and work out, when you see problems with the way your client wants things to be handled, and the way to balance, you know, what is the law versus what they want to do. And I know the governor, and he's a reasonable man, and I have full faith in my ability to work with him, but exercise the independent judgment I need to.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
I believe that for now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Further questions? Senator Coghill.
Going back to your work with the governor, how long, once again, just remind me, you started with him what year and up to this date?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, July of 2003, to the best of my recollection.
It's been a good while, okay.
It has been.
In my neck of the woods, I know the governor has been a strong advocate in the Port Authority. You worked with him during the formulation of the Port Authority between the communities?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I actually did not. I think the Port Authority was founded in 1999, and I didn't really work any Port Authority business until probably 2005. But I certainly did work with the governor on the Port Authority's behalf.
Who did outside of the governor, who did you work with for, you know, yes, anything that the Port Authority had to do structurally or legally?
Could you reframe the question, please, Senator?
Well, you went to work on Port Authority issues in 2009. Was it structural issues to the workings, or was it legal issues on the pathway forward?
Okay. Senator Coghill, so I represented the Port Authority across its functions, including everything from day-to-day. You know, I probably chaired, or didn't chair as a lawyer, I probably took minutes, you know, with 5 or 10 meetings over the years. I provided legal advice on a number of issues that were small. I helped worked on strategy for the Port Authority. I helped worked on the proposal in 2010 to do North Slope Trucking Project. And I certainly worked on gas line, including a whole number of issues associated. In particular, what jumps to mind is the Port Authority did an AGIA application in 2007. Originally, you know, it started with BG and Williams, but BG and Williams dropped out, so it became just the Port Authority. I worked extensively on that. I've done a lot of their business, Senator.
And were you there when the North Slope Borough pulled out?
I was, Senator.
And so what was the devolution of authority from there? Did it just land in Fairbanks and Valdez's lap?
Senator, that's correct.
Okay. And at that point, I know you've worked with then Mayor Whitaker, right?
Yes, Senator.
And so now we have you, Mayor Whitaker, and the governor all in office, and we have just a perceived conflict, in my view. And so how do you see working with them putting up firewalls?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I would say that there, at least from a legal standpoint, there isn't a conflict in my representation of the governor's because of prior work that here I did on the last Gas Line Port Authority's behalf. There's no standing issues that I'm aware of that associate any kind of legal conflict.
I think because we're trying to put together an energy project that is trucking, that we're trying to put together a Alaska standalone pipeline that has similar structures to the Port Authority. Help me understand how the internal discussion with you all doesn't become a conflict to Alaskans.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, so I guess I'm trying to answer your question directly, but as an attorney, I take conflict out of a pretty specific meaning.
I probably
could
have done better at asking the question, but these are the things that we talk about, you know, with us legislators. We see all the people involved in it now in office, and we're told that there's no conflict, and I see one just as glaring can be, and I want to know how you're going to handle it.
Well, so, Senator, in terms of a perceived conflict, that I use the word perceived underlined because I don't believe there exists an actual ethical conflict, or I would build barriers between myself and any potential conflicts. But to the extent that you're concerned at all about any action that this administration takes, I mean, I think we have the necessary things in place. Take the F&G trucking deal, for instance. I mean, there is a separation of powers. ADA is an independent board. They're looking at it independent. You know, I believe that those will function, and they function well in the state of Alaska.
So I'll lean, Madam Chair, I'll lean on ADA to help me out with that. But that brings up another name that I just ask you to add to the mix, because there's been a lot of representation and a lot of work, and I just need to hear from you what that work is between you and the Brenna Law Firm, because I hear rate cases being brought up. Mm-hmm. And you delaying rate cases. And once again, we see it looks like a conflict. And so help me understand my way through that.
Certainly. So I'm happy to explain the work that I've done, Senator Coghill, through the chair with Mr. Brenna in particular is I believe what you're talking about. The primary, I've handled two cases with Mr. Brenner that I can think of off the top of my head, or two categories of cases. The first is Mr. Brenner represented the Fairbanks North Star Borough in the TAPS valuation disputes. I represented the City of Valdez. So in that representation, we did work together. The only other time that I have handled a case with Mr. Brenner was in approximately 2012. He hired me to represent his client, Tesoro and Anadarko, and the SR FERC case for about 6 months. So those are the only two cases that I'm aware of that that I've worked with Mr. Brenner on.
Follow-up, Senator Cargill.
First of all, you knew that these questions were going to come up, so thank you for at least taking the position and facing into it. And we're just looking for good, reasonable answers is all we're doing. I'm trying not to sound like a hunt because I'm not on a hunt. These are things that I'm just gathering from what's reported and what I've seen. We want energy in Fairbanks, there's no doubt about it. But does it put you in a conflict when they start asking for legal opinions on things that you've been in court or advised clients on? That can you separate how you defended a client, for example, and how you might defend Alaska very, very differently? You have huge latitudes in discretion on how you give opinions. Everybody's looking for an AG opinion on something, right? And your conflicts go way deep into these oil and gas issues. So how do you separate that?
Well, Senator Cargill, through the chair, I think that there's – so first of all, I wouldn't take any action or make any decision on any matter in which I had a conflict that was not – that well, that, full stop. I mean, if I have a legal conflict, I will handle it accordingly. And, in fact, I was extremely diligent on the front end of coming into office of making sure I did everything in the most transparent and ethically appropriate way. That includes – getting an outside legal opinion on what my prior representation of clients might mean as my role as Attorney General. I met with the ethics attorneys in the Department of Law before I took office and was given formal advice on how to proceed with any existing or apparent conflicts. And I did precisely what they told me to do, which was to delegate, I believe, four cases to Martin Schultz. There were oil and gas cases. And to delegate the authority of my office to him to handle those matters. He's the head of the oil and gas and mining section, which is precisely what prior attorney generals, including General Burns and General Garrity, did with their cases that involved the state. So in that capacity, to the extent that there was any ongoing conflict, I've handled them exactly as I was instructed to.
Madam Chair?
Yes, follow-up, Senator.
I just have a couple more questions. I just wanted to go down this because I figured you'd probably looked into it. Any smart man would have, and I count you as a very smart man. But you did bring up a couple of things that I found my way through, and that is perceived and actual conflicts. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to the committee how those are handled? Because I found pages and pages on that, on just what a perceived conflict and what an actual conflict are. Help us so that people listening to us know that we're really aware of what that perceived is. And then after that, what I'd like to know is, did we now, because of those perceived conflict, have to hand to somebody other than an AG what would normally be an attorney general's job?
Senator Coghill, I mean, the difference between a perceived conflict and an actual one, I mean, I'm not sure that they're terms of art, but I'll tell you how I think about them, and I think it's probably in line with yours. An actual conflict is one where you have a conflict of interest under the law or under professional ethics. A perceived conflict, I guess, would be where someone, where you don't have an actual conflict, but someone might still be concerned about the appearance of one. In terms of your second question about whether or not, because of my prior representation in oil and gas cases, we have to bring in outside attorneys, the answer is no. The one exception I'm aware of is that normally ethics advice is given to the lieutenant governor by the ethics opinion in the Department of Law, but he specifically asked that if I move to remove my delegations in any of the cases that I've delegated my authority, that he be allowed to retain outside legal counsel to provide him advice, and I did approve him, that outside attorney, when and if he would ever want to use them.
And I see that as a delegation of what we would expect an AG. But in any case, I've had several other questions, but I'm going to stop there right now.
Further questions, committee members? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. What would you, if you were to clarify, what are your, you call your biggest legal victories involving the state and the industry, things that would really be worthy of like a notch on your gun? But as the lawyers are certainly, appropriately take a lot of pride when they've won a tough case.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, you mean as a private attorney?
As a private attorney.
Well, that's good, because as an AG, I haven't had many chances to have any big...
I know, you're still in the development stage.
So I'll give you one big loser and one big winner. How about that, Senator?
Oh, we have more than that, though. I mean, I don't want you to dredge out losers, but broader expansive. This is part of the confirmation process, Madam Chair.
Certainly. So probably the case that I worked on that I had the biggest professional win was the TAPS ad valorem case, where on behalf of the city of Valdez, the taxable value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System was raised from $3 billion to approximately $10 billion. That was, as an attorney representing my client, many years of litigation, hard fought, hard won, and I think a good and just result for my client, and I'm happy and proud of the work I did in that case. I told you I'd give you one that I lost, too. And there was a vessel tax that the city levied on, the city of Valdez levied on vessels over 95 feet in length. That was, the ad valorem tax was challenged as relates to the oil tankers that called at Port Valdez, and the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately ruled the tax unconstitutional. So I think that one win, one loss.
Madam Chair, any other wins, though, that you would, even on smaller issues?
Senator Stoltz, it's funny. It's such a, it should be so obvious, but nothing's floating to mind right off the top of my head. So I was certainly...
nothing to brag about?
nothing comes to mind, Senator.
Well, Madam Chair, I was hoping one of my astute colleagues is to say, even if the best attorney to have is someone that's kicked you in the butt in the previous iteration, that you know they're a good attorney, and I was looking for... if somebody that's beat you is somebody you want to have on your side sometimes the next time, and maybe you can think of some more good ones where you...
Thank you, Senator. I'll try to come up with some here by the end.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd say getting a $10 billion victory in the TAPS case is probably a huge, huge victory, not only for you, but for the people of Alaska. Can you talk about how much taxpayer money was saved by doing that, number one? And then maybe to help the committee, who have you represented over the years? Can you talk about some of your clients and some of the types of cases that you've litigated over the years?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So my client list, you know, going back to when I was at Wolforth, Vassar, Johnson & Breck, I mean, it's been over the years, I've done a lot of public finance work, so it's been the railroad, it's been AHSC, it's been Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, it's been Anchorage Wastewater Utility, it's been the Municipality of Anchorage, it's been the City of Valdez, it's been the Aleutians East Borough, I've certainly represented Kenai. I would say, I mean, a good chunk of Alaska municipalities that are public corporations that are involved in the issuance of municipal bonds, I've certainly represented. On the municipal side, I've represented in various matters. On tax matters, I've represented Valdez, I've represented Kenai, I've represented the Aleutians East Borough, or you know, done work for the attorney who is the primary representative. Joe Levesque represented the Aleutians East Borough, and when he was at my firm, I worked with him many times on that client. City of Sandpoint. Those are just a few that comes to mind. In terms of litigation, I mean, I really did focus in my litigation practice until the last year or two, where it broadened a little bit. I really did focus on oil and gas tax cases, so most of my representation was for the city of Valdez and oil and gas tax matters, as well as a few other clients. Like I said, I handled some AS 4356 issues for Kenai. That comes to mind. But I would say that the last year or two of my practice, I'd always consider myself a transactional attorney and a finance guy, and that was my background. But the last 3 or 4 years, I was really finding I enjoyed litigation, so was broadening out my practice, took on a couple of construction cases, some other complex litigation.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Do you feel up to the task of managing workforce over at the Department of Law.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, thank you, I do. I mean, it is the largest law firm in the state, but I do have extensive experience in managing complex litigation and complex transactions, and I don't know that there's too many people in the state of Alaska as attorneys that have managed 500 people, but I've certainly been a manager for well over a half dozen years in terms of complex legal issues, and I believe I have the skill set to do the job.
Follow-up?
Everyone here has different opinions on the TAPS cases, and I know we've had, talked about it in this committee many times, and not to get into specifics, but just to give people sort of the magnitude of that case and, how many documents we're talking with, how many exhibits, how long the litigation was. I mean, just so you can give people a feel of how much work that actually was and how complex that was.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, so in my prior representation of the City of Valdez and the TAPS value cases, the litigation really started in earnest in late 2004. There has been a 3 to 6 day hearing, usually a 3 day hearing before the State Assessment Review Board every single year since then, save one, which was 2012. Ultimately, each of those hearings has resulted in appeals to the Alaska Superior Court. Those appeals were some of the largest and most complex, trials, in the history of the state of Alaska, involved millions of documents. Every tax year, 2% of the value. So when the dispute is about a $3 billion value versus a $10 billion value, the amount of money you're talking about is 2% of $7 billion in terms of ultimate taxes collected by state and local governments. So the sums of money over 10 years are huge. Each of those cases, there were two major trials that I handled. Each of those cases involved 3-4 dozen witnesses, 100 depositions, million pages in documents, thousands of exhibits. Legal teams on both sides running to the tune of maybe 8 to 10 lawyers, equal number of paralegals, and all of the support you need to handle complex litigation like that. And ultimately, of course, ended up in appeals to the state Supreme Court as well.
Follow-up?
Yeah, just one last one. And there's some questions about conflicts of interest, and can you just talk a little bit about, as an attorney, one day you're on one side of an issue, and the next day maybe you have a different client who has a different take on something. Obviously, you're not going to be able to represent someone against the other client, but talk a little bit about how attorneys deal and how you deal with conflicts. I mean, you understand you're not representing Valdez anymore. You're representing a statewide, the state of Alaska and the people of Alaska, and talk a little bit about how is this a common issue for attorneys dealing with conflicts, and how attorneys deal with that, and how you plan on dealing with it?
Well, Senator Wilikowski, it's common in the sense of it certainly happens. It's not common that many people have the opportunity to step into the Attorney General's role, but as I said, the way I'm handling it is that I've worked very closely with Ethics Counsel and an independent counsel that I hired myself to understand what the conflicts are under law of the state of Alaska and to where those conflicts exist, take the appropriate steps, as the ethics opinions attorneys have told me to do. The couple of cases that I handled against the state, the TAPS value case in particular, was a large case, but it was just one of thousands of cases that the Department of Law has before it. So, although I do have delegations in place for a few of those cases, it's a small part of the total book of business. And there's no conflict. The mere fact that I was represented against the state in one case doesn't create conflicts in other cases. So I've certainly managed my conflicts appropriately where they existed, as have other attorney generals. But I believe it makes me, I believe my prior experience in the oil and gas realm makes me a better attorney for the state, not a worse one. I understand the issues in a way that certainly some attorney generals probably haven't with their backgrounds. And I believe I'm well suited to represent the state and the people of the state of Alaska as best as possible in those arenas.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski. So, since we're talking about TAPS valuation, you're now the Attorney General for the state. So you're sitting on the other side of the table in such a valuation case. Could we expect the same vigor and diligence as you represent the state on the other side of the table?
Senator Geisel, absolutely. I am a zealous advocate for my client.
Seems like that would be difficult for you to suddenly change your viewpoints. It's not?
I think as a lawyer, it's a common thing to do. So first of all, I do have delegations in place. So I'm not representing the state. Those have been delegated. But at a more theoretical level, taking a step back, I think as an attorney, I certainly have the ability to understand who my current client is and zealously advocate on their behalf.
Further questions, Senator Stedman?
Well, I think that gets to the point of, you know, we're all beating around the bush here, but it just gives a lot of people indigestion that you represented Valdez in the Dapps case against the oil industry. That's the point, along with probably some of your other clients and some folks may have indigestion with that. I personally would prefer to hire the winner than the loser. Okay? And I look at attorneys as they're hired guns. And you hire a guy, if I was Valdez and hired Mr. Richards, I'd be very happy that he won the case. And if I was on the other side, I'd probably look at hiring Mr. Richards for me in the next fight. And I could relate that back to an incident I had a few years ago in Sitka dealing with a stolen anchor. A guy, the attorney had thought, the attorney for the fellow that stole my anchor, it's a 10,000-pound anchor, no, little anchor, thought I'd be mad at him. I happened to sit down with him next to him on an airplane and didn't recognize him. And he thought, when I found out who he was, I wasn't going to talk to him. Well, that's just the exact opposite. Next time I have a problem, I'd rather hire him. You know, he's just doing his job. So I think we need to set some of this stuff aside. And as long as we can be assured that the positions that the citizens coming forward and to work as a public official can set that stuff aside and act in the best interest of the people in the state, then we ought to be thankful. You know, my concern... Another concern I have is dealing with the oil and gas industry being the biggest, most influential industry and the most financially important industry to the state. No disrespect to fishing. I think it's good that we have a candidate here that understands the complexities of the issues. I would be a little bit gun-shy to have an attorney general that was clueless in our biggest and most important area. So. I think Mr. Richards has done a good job, you know, answering the questions. I just, not hesitant to put it straight to him. And I think that's the issue at hand. Can you move to the middle? And so far, it appears that's to be the case, but every one of us will decide that when we walk in and vote yes or no.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. And I'll just say that I was honored to represent the city of Valdez, but if I'd been hired by an oil company instead, I would have provided the same level of zealous advocacy for them as I did for the city. It's the nature of being an attorney.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any suggestion over the Valdez case. That's, I think it's been aptly stated whether it's certainly very subjectively debatable and objectively debatable whether that was good or bad for the state and the communities, and it's part of a larger discussion. I mean, some of our communities were pretty ecstatic, and certainly it did have an impact on the Treasury, and we've had a lot of debates dealing with that, so I don't have any suggestion over that. That's just that was the finding of a legal proceeding, and it's settled law now. I do have a question about a specific case, which was a part of the campaign, and when there were promises made about litigation, as reported by the Ketchikan Daily News, and that's the school funding lawsuit, and again, probably have constituents on both sides of that saying it's good or bad, depending on our property taxpayers probably like it, and our folks that are concerned about the state treasury are pretty squeamish, but the governor did make some specific campaign statements, and there was a recent, within the last couple of weeks, an editorial by Lou Williams, certainly a very prominent figure, the publisher and editor of the Ketchikan Daily News, said, well, let's give the governor a little time to work this out, give him a break, and let's see how he plays on this one. But it is playing politically, and can you describe the interplay on that case? It certainly has a lot of anxiety amongst, and maybe hope amongst some of the local property taxpayers, but concern amongst another entity of government.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, So I can certainly describe where we are with the litigation.
Were you involved at all in the campaign as a contributor and an advisor?
Senator Stoltz, I was involved in the campaign. I was not involved in anything related to the Ketchikan lawsuit.
No.
So the only thing I know about the governor's position is what I read in the paper 6 months ago about something he said at a debate, if I recall. But I will tell you that the state of Alaska is on track to appeal the Superior Court's decision and maintain the same litigation positions as were taken in the last administration. So to the extent that you're concerned about a change in position, I don't believe that's what's happening with the appeals that we're filing.
Senator Stoltz,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Cargill.
Thank you. The fact that you've been so good at amassing these tons and tons of paper and being able to navigate really complex issues, for me, that's good, because some of the complex issues are going to be defending Alaska. There's no doubt about it. And I had a nice conversation with you on the Sturgeon case, and immediately had buyer's remorse on it, and then I had to go study it, and then I figured out, well, yes, maybe he was right, and then I, you know. So the Sturgeon case deals with somebody who was using the airboat. We had allowed permitting, and then the question of our right to that waterway became the real question. And it was a little more complex than my unlearned brain could take, but I think I understand what you said. So could you tell us where we're going to go with defending Alaska on this? Because to me, defending Alaska on our right to waterways is a very, very big deal. And if my buyer's remorse part was right, I want to know if the permitting issue is really the hang-up. Could you explain to us where we need to go to defend Alaska with regard to the Sturgeon case?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I can, and I'd be happy to. I'm just trying to think how to do it in a public setting. So let me first tell you where we are and what we're doing, and that's public. So what we're doing is we are filing an amicus in support of Mr. Sturgeon's petition for cert, but the state has decided, I've decided, it's my decision, not to file an appeal of the state's case, because the state's case really devolved into a standing question. And it was the view of the Department of Law and myself that there are probably better fact patterns that the state can pursue in the future that will be better to have before the courts, where we're not sort of fighting about whether or not we have standing effectively.
And I appreciate that. But could you tell us, we're the resource committee, what does it mean, standing? Because we only see our water rights slipping away from us. And if this was a bad precedent for us to stand on, or if there's other things that we can get that really create a better way for us to defend the state's right to that water.
Certainly, Senator. What the courts held in our case, which is distinct from Sturgeon's, was that we couldn't bring the lawsuit, and we couldn't bring the lawsuit because the activity had already occurred, so it was moot. So they weren't even willing to address the legal issues associated with the case, and instead the courts decided that effectively we didn't even have any grounds to bring the case because essentially the permits had already been collected and the water samples had been collected and the activity had already occurred. And since the activity already occurred, we don't have standing to make a legal challenge as to whether or not the feds had the right to make us do the activity. So it was moot. And you know, federal courts aren't like state courts. The state of Alaska, generally speaking, is pretty liberal with standing. If you have an interest that's impacted and you feel like the court should address your interests and look at the legal issues you want to bring to the court, you know, as a general rule, the state of Alaska court system is generally going to be willing to decide legal issues. A federal jurisdiction is a very different animal, and the federal courts are much more narrow about when they'll decide legal cases. And this is just an instance where they decided they didn't want to decide the legal case. And it's very, very rare for the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a circuit decision on standing grounds.
Hello?
Just on that one issue, and then I'll go to other questions later on. But so would you vigorously defend the state of Alaska's right to the waterways in Alaska?
Senator Cogdell, through the chair, yes.
Senator Stoltz, did I see your hand? No.
I will now. Yeah, I do have a question.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, Madam Chair, the Attorney General, General Richards, can you explain, I'm going to just preface it, the longest tenured Attorney General in the history of Alaska has a formal but yet informal role in this administration as an advisor. I'm told he has an office and, you know, he's got a key to the magical doors that are locked to everybody else, and he can get in and out, and that'd be former Attorney General Botello. Can you describe his role as in the kitchen cabinet Attorney General, or what interaction you've had with him, and helping us understand his role and explain it as you understand it?
Senator Stoll, through the chair, happy to. So General Botello was involved in helping set up the transition process for the administration. The governor and the lieutenant governor had a big meeting, and probably not the most sophisticated way to describe it, but a transition meeting in Anchorage with a couple hundred folks, and he was the lead on organizing that, or one of the leads. And then he, when the governor and the lieutenant governor came into office, he did work for approximately 2.5-3 months in the governor's office, essentially helping with transition. He hasn't been in that position for a while, a couple weeks maybe. So his current role is none.
Follow-up?
Madam Chair, he still lives in Juneau, right? Does he have still have access to come in freely and have a desk? Or is, I'm only going, I don't spend a lot of time back. It's a pretty formal visit. They tell me where I can go when I go into the room that I'm invited into. So I'm not sure of all the structure. We only know, Madam Chair, I'm just going by. And I apologize, but almost anecdotal and sometimes rumor, some better verified than others, but kind of clumsily climb my way through this. It's an important dynamic to have such a prominent role. And he's been gone for a couple of weeks. Is he just on a cruise for a while, or is he? You think he's going to come back? Is it formalized that he's now turned in the keys and left, or what is the situation?
Oh, well, Senator Stoltz, I certainly don't want to be the guy that fired Bruce Botello in a but it's my understanding that he has left, and he's left for good. That's my understanding. I'm sure that a direct inquiry to the governor's office will confirm or not. But it's my understanding that he's been done with the administration for several weeks. And, yeah.
Thank you. That's helpful. I appreciate knowing that.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Back to Senator Coghill's question on navigable waters and keeping mean high tide and below in the state preview, and for that matter, rivers and some of the lakes. Can you give us just a little bit of background, how much exposure you've had in your legal practice dealing with those issues? And the point being, we lost the case with Glacier Bay, so that now it's a federal park. And, you know, they would have liked to have had maybe the entire southeast waterways, which, frankly, some of us find extremely alarming. But can you give us a little background on your background on those type of cases?
So, Senator Stedman, through the chair, I mean, honestly, my background isn't that deep. I had, as a law clerk working for Ralph Beislein, one equals footing case, one navigability case that involved the Minto Flats, effectively, and whether that was navigable waters. So became familiar with the body of law and understand it at a high level. But that was, you know, 13 or 14 years ago, and I haven't personally litigated any of those cases before. But I'm certainly in the process, like many things, of learning, and one thing I will commit to is I will study hard. And I have, I mean, attorneys that have worked in this area full-time for many years that really handle the cases on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, one of the advantages of being Attorney General is you just have an incredible depth to go to in terms of individual attorneys to help you get up to speed and make decisions.
This is a follow-up.
Oh, pardon me. Yes, follow-up, Senator Stedman.
My recommendation is don't give them an inch. Because we lose it, we never get it back. Mm-hmm. And it just continues on.
Thank you, Senator.
Which is kind of in keeping with my concern about the not challenging the standing that the state was denied in the sturgeon case. Yes, of course, we applied for the permits. We got them. The fish were sampled. The genetics were obtained. However, going forward, no doubt we'll want to do it again. And we were denied standing. So haven't we relinquished now some element of control?
Senator Diesel, through the chair, no, I don't believe we have. If I thought, well, I'll just be frank. The one question I asked the attorneys handling the case when I was confronted with the decision of whether to file a cert on the same claims was, if we don't, are we in any way negatively impacted to bring a future case in the future? And I asked it on several different occasions and got the same answer multiple times, which is no. And in fact, we think we can find a case and will find a case over the coming years where standing isn't an issue. So that's the goal.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Coghill?
Yeah, and several people who follow that closely just have nipped at my heels saying, help, because we'll never find, and we're always looking out to the future for another case. So if we had lost that that standing, what damage would have done under that case?
Senator Coghill, I mean, the damage, the probability of winning was like in the 1%, and I don't like to go to the U.S. Supreme Court with the state of Alaska taking 1% shots. I just think we're better off finding a better case with that's more arguable rather than taking such a low probability shot, particularly when we have a slightly higher probability shot and an amicus ability to support Sturgeon's petition itself.
And thank you for doing that. Could I ask one other question?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The federal government is both our friend and our enemy. I mean, we love working with them in so many areas, but there's also been some regulatory flow over the last few years that have been significant, EPA probably being one of them, the OCS, Marine Mammal Protection Act, and it just you start naming them. But one of the things I'm concerned about up in the interior is the 111D rule. And I've heard from the Department of DEC, I almost called them Department of Economic Collapse, I'm sorry. I've been using that funny in my office, and it almost came out. But I understand that they're just looking for an exception to the rule, and I've got some pretty good case law or pretty good legal opinions, I should, that's a better way of saying it, that they're outside the Constitution on this 111D rule. And I've encouraged your office at least to take a good hard look at it. And have you had a chance to look at that? Do you think we have a case to make with the other states, or do you think we have to depend upon the Region 10 to give us flexibility?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I haven't delved deep in on the 111D case yet. I mean, I'm basically familiar with the case and what it's about. I do know that we did win in a panel before the Ninth Circuit, and that it's going to full hearing before the Ninth Circuit. So, I don't know enough about the individual issues to know whether or not we have a valid constitutional claim outside of just the standard, the main line of attack or the main line of case we're bringing, which is that the EPA was out of bounds in requiring CO2 compliance without a cost-based analysis on the electric utility side.
Follow-up?
We did some gathering of brief materials, and I think we've gotten it to you, and I'd hope you'd consider that. I think we as a state, joining with other states' attorneys general, have a very strong case to make, including going to our congressional delegation. So I would encourage you to do that. Who is your lead on federal litigation issues?
Well, Senator Coghill, through the chair, there's a bunch of different attorneys that handle it in the natural resources section and otherwise. The statehood defense attorney is Kent Sullivan. Aunt Nelson handles a bunch of the federal pushback cases. I don't know actually who's handling the 111D case, but I'm happy to make sure that whatever materials you have are reviewed.
And I'll only bring up one other issue.
Yes.
That is coming our way, and it's the land in the trust issue, which is mostly a native issue, but it could have a huge impact on how lands are handled and managed in Alaska and have a huge impact on the state. And so I know that there's been some work on that. Is that something that you're aware of, alert to?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, believe me, it's something I'm learning. It's a big issue for the state with massive policy implications. The federal government reversed its position. Interior did. A few months ago, rules became final. Of course, it had always been Interior's position that lands could not be put into trust, and there wasn't Indian law in Alaska. The Obama administration has wholesale reversed that position and adopted regulations that do allow it. The state is in the process of challenging that. It's currently before the D.C. Circuit, and certainly I'm looking at it.
And I appreciate that because in many ways our ability to traverse and produce on the lands in Alaska are going to depend upon cooperation between us, the federal government, and native landholders. And that throws us a curve that could literally bottle us up into several generations. So I hope that you'll take that seriously. So thank you.
Good. Senator Stoltz.
Madam Chair, I have about a half a dozen fisheries issues, but I'll just ask one and a half questions. One first, Mr. Attorney General, I believe in 2010 or 2011, somewhere around 2000, Attorney General Sullivan agreed to aggressively pursue the state's position on the United Cook Inlet Drift Association lawsuit, and they were seeking to have the case in federal court to bring in federal management under the Magnuson-Stevens. Are you familiar with that case? And I just believe we'll pause here because one of the main instigators of the case, the governor actively sought to put on the Board of Fisheries, and that caused me a lot of pause about having that UCEDA representative. When there's signals, I don't know. Sometimes when somebody rings me inside the head with a shovel, I notice it, and sometimes things are more subtle. Can you tell me your understanding of that case and what the administration's commitment is on that?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, I don't know anything about the case. I haven't had the opportunity to even read a brief on it. So I suspect that that means that, I know that means that there haven't been any active decisions that have had to been made. So I'm not familiar with the background. But I would be happy to follow up in your office and discuss it with you.
It is being appealed. And another real quick one, when we had a Fish and Game Budget Committee hearing, there was a lot of concern about the subsistence net that's being that's proposed to be strung on the Kenai River and the issue of conservation and protecting species. They said that was critical that we not have that beachhead on that. And right now we have an ongoing case, the Estrada case. And the person in the administration who has been identified as having a very enhanced role on fisheries issues, Lieutenant Governor Malott was sitting in on the case. As an attorney general and chief law enforcement officer on an issue where the state is aggressively pursuing a position against Estrada et al., did it provide any discomfort, even on the optics level of appearance, having the Lieutenant Governor sitting there when he has such a prominent fishing role, sitting in on that case when the state was, as our own Fish and Game managers, if the state were to lose that case, it would create an incredible precedence and diminish our conservation ability. So any thoughts on that, just the optics of having one of our chief members of the administration, and have you talked to him about that?
So, Senator Stoltz, I was not aware, and frankly not aware of what you're talking about, whether he attended a hearing or something like that.
A criminal proceeding?
No, I'm not aware of that. I do know that the state's position is briefed and on appeal, and no change of action has been taken since this administration took over.
I'm sure I'll try one.
Yes.
Had you been aware, what would have you had any concerns?
I don't know enough about the circumstances of the fact pattern. I mean, to have an opinion, Senator.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if we're going to have another opportunity to continue this. We're near. I know you have a rigid rule on 5 o'clock, but these are I probably threw a couple of bombs, right? Rhetorical or even metaphorical bombs, but they're very critical issues and determining where we are on some of these things. And my constituents will want to know. So, can we leave? I'd sure like to have a chance to visit those again, not just in my office. I think these rise to the level of having public answers.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. It is actually a minute before 5, and I also have additional questions. So I think it would be appropriate, because of the gravity of resource development, of course, for our state, to have Mr. Richards back another time. I think I certainly have more questions. You indicated that you did, so we'll plan to do that. Mr. Richards, thank you so much for being here today. And we will get in touch with your office in terms of scheduling another time to ask some additional questions. But thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
With that, Thank you. With that, the time is now 5 p.m., and we will adjourn. Our next meeting is next Wednesday, or excuse me, this coming Wednesday, and we will hear HJR 6 as well as the governor's appointee to the Department of Natural Resources. We stand adjourned.